Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You know, Friday, this time of day is when we have an hour to figure out what happened this week and what it all means. And I've got a panel of friends here. Tyrone Beeson, social justice columnist for the Seattle Times. Welcome, Tyrone.
Great to be here.
We have Erica C. Barnett. She writes at thecisforcrank.com. Great to see you again. Thanks, Erica.
Likewise.
Monica Nicholsberg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we're live tweeting the show at KUOW. First of all, an orca whale in our local waters is what? Is she grieving? Is she hurting herself? Is she rousing us from apathy? She is also known as Tahlequah, the mother of a calf, an orca calf that died last week, soon after it was born. She's been carrying her dead calf on her back ever since. An unusually long time, and it might be hurting Tahlequah. The orca researcher Taylor Shedd from the education group Soundwatch joined us on the air on Wednesday from his boat in the Georgia Strait, the Strait of Georgia, as he was tracking Tahlequah, and he told us this.
We're trying to figure out if she's being provisioned or if she's feeding at all, because this now would be day 9 that maybe she hasn't had anything to eat. So we're starting to be concerned maybe for her health. You know, we're hoping that she's okay. We have seen her drop the calf a few times and do some surface behaviors. We saw her breach and a behavior we call cartwheeling, where she throws her tail in the air. But then after those instances, we saw her take a deep dive, obviously, to go retrieve the calf again. So that gives us a little bit of hope that she does have the ability to drop the calf and do some other behaviors. I haven't really seen her display any foraging behaviors, chasing fish herself. We have seen her family members and lots of other whales display some of those behaviors. So hopefully they're catching fish and provisioning her with some food.
Now, a lot of people have been saying this orca is in mourning. She's grieving her lost child. Maybe in a way she's protesting, said University of Washington whale biologist Dr. Deborah Giles.
If she was able to hold up a protest sign, I think that she would be saying, I'm starving. We need more fish. My whole family needs more fish. We can't have our babies born and survive because we're starving.
So, Erica, the worldwide attention to this orca calf's death, what does it seem like it's adding up to?
Well, I mean, I think that we have a tendency to over-anthropomorphize charismatic megafauna, which I think is actually like the technical term.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sometimes that is
big
true.
Animals that we can relate to
exactly.
More than little ones.
Yeah, I mean, I saw somebody write a column about how this renews his belief in God. And I mean, that's great for humans, but I wonder if it distracts us from the bigger questions that are actually leading to orca decline and to the fact that, you know, we have our orcas that are starving and not being able to reproduce and, you know, the shrinking gene pool. You know, and that gets to another story that we're going to discuss about sea lions,
right.
And this idea of shooting them in order to allow more salmon to get through for orca to feed on. You know, the big picture solutions are always really hard, and they have to do with things like not allowing big tankers into, or as many big tankers into places where, you know, into habitat, and climate change, and just all the things that we, and, you know, spills.
Dams
and things that, you know, actually take a lot of political will to fix. So I worry that it's a lot easier to focus on, oh my gosh, I totally relate to this orca. Like, if that was my child, how would I feel? So that's my only concern when people kind of fixate on these very, you know, sad stories.
Well, some people think that anthropomorphizing distracts. Some people think the anthropomorphizing makes us care. What do you think, Tyrone?
I was just going to add that my colleague Linda Mapes wrote a great lead for one of her stories about this, and it's is it her grief or ours? And I think that there's something really sweet about the story, but it's also a little bit problematic because there are practical things that people can do once we've sort of moved out of our mourning period for the mourning orca, like not eat Chinook salmon. I mean, I was just reading some of the coverage from KUOW. Mm-hmm. It's a practical thing that people can do. So not even political will, but just personal decision making. Also, don't flush your drugs down the toilet.
Yeah, your prescription meds.
Yeah, so there are things that people can do.
Your detergents.
Yeah, to move beyond the spectacle of what's happening before us, and that they can incorporate into their everyday lives.
Since you brought it up, let me just play a bit of that. Dr. Giles, who we heard from earlier, this is her telling you about the choice you make to eat Chinook salmon.
I recognize that Chinook salmon are the tastiest and most desirable for humans to eat. The whales feel the same way. The difference is that the southern resident killer whales rely on Chinook salmon for their lives. They're fairly rigid in what they'll eat, and Chinook salmon are what they evolved to eat. And so the fact that there aren't that many fish, not as many fish returning to their natal rivers as there used to be, that's where the problem comes in, is that the whales are competing with humans for the same fish, and there's just not as many of them.
Monica, what are you thinking about?
I was just thinking that while, there is a danger in putting too much human emotion on creatures that experience the world differently, I would say that whales and cetaceans are highly emotional and highly social animals, and something as visceral as a grieving mother putting on this huge display and at her own expense is the reason that we're all talking about this, and maybe the reason that some people are going to learn that they shouldn't be eating Chinook salmon. So I think that if she's trying to send a message, perhaps it's working.
Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, the Seattle Times talked with this doctoral candidate at the UW School of Environmental and Forest Sciences. I don't know how to say her name, Kaylee Swift. And she said, the sad part of this story should not be that she's sad. It should be that our critically endangered pod lost another calf, as we talked about. And then she says, my hope would be that we wouldn't require animals to experience the world like we do to have compassion for them and to want to protect them.
Well, and we have selfish reasons for, not wanting our ecosystems to fall apart. I mean, so even if, I don't really believe in over-empathizing with animals, particularly if you eat animals. But, I mean, pigs are incredibly smart and, perhaps experience emotions, for example. But I think I agree with Monica, if it causes us to actually pay attention to our own behavior, then that's a net positive. I just don't think we should impart human emotions necessarily into creatures whose experiences we just can't understand.
Does it matter whether this one calf's death had anything to do with climate change or pollution? Or you're hearing a lot of people make a connection to what this death means, and there's sort of a literal connection and a symbolic connection.
Well, it's the first calf that was born to this pod in 3 years, right? So whether or not this calf's death was a direct result of climate change, to me, like, that's a big part of this story. And in the interest of anthropomorphizing further, it kind of reminds me of The Handmaid's Tale, where it's been years since this family has had any babies, and it's a matriarchal social structure, and it's very important for them to care for their offspring. It's, I think, like scientists would say, one of their biggest driving factors, similar to humans in a lot of ways. And in that show, everyone goes kind of insane because no one can have children. And that's just what I'm reminded of in this story, because she's doing something really unusual and really, she's getting sick, she's starving. And to me, it seems like it's not just because she lost her child, but maybe because it was the one glimmer of hope for this pod in years.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that she can't do what she feels, I don't know what the word is, called, or in, that's what she is in a way, and that it's not unheard of to carry a calf along like this, but not for near this long. Another thing that this doctor told us, Dr. Giles, from the UW, a whale biologist, she said, talk to your local politicians is another, if you're wondering, well, what can I do? What can I do? We mentioned non-biodegradable solvent detergents and stuff you're flushing, and your antidepressants, and your salmon diet. Are you just gonna not eat salmon?
I mean, I think we have other salmon options, as one of your guests mentioned.
Yeah. Chinook. It's this orcas cannot seem to so far move beyond the Chinook as the prime source.
Yeah, I mean, I think, but one of the issues that politicians can deal with, but probably won't if history is any guide, is, there's another pipeline that I believe is going right through this habitat. you know, maybe people should look at that and consider whether it's something to lobby against. I mean, there's always an individual solution that you can do that is going to be less effective than doing an actual political solution. So we can recycle, but that doesn't, you know, reverse climate change. We can buy electric cars, but that doesn't reverse, you know, sprawl patterns that are the result of, you know, governmental policies. So, I mean, we shouldn't be flushing our drugs down the toilet. We should change our individual behaviors. But ultimately, there are political solutions that are a lot harder that need to be at least talked about that I'm not seeing discussed.
Well, as you said, one thing to do to boost the Chinook salmon that orcas feed on is to kill sea lions that kill the salmon. And this week, a U.S. Senate committee passed a bill co-sponsored by Washington Senator Maria Cantwell. There's a companion bill in the House that is supported by Jamie Herrera Butler in our 3rd District, Southwest Washington, and it authorizes permits to shoot up to 900 sea lions a year that gather at the dams, the fish ladders, and they just feast on endangered salmon and steelhead runs. And there are a lot of questions about this. Will it work? I spoke to Guido Rahr, the president and CEO of the Wild Salmon Center, and he said this is something we've got to do. And once you lose a wild fish population that's adapted to a certain place, you won't get it back.
And this has become such a crisis that we've got to allow the fish managers the flexibility to deal with these with the California sea lions. And there's just no other way around it. So we take it very seriously. But we're at the 11th hour right now. Once you lose a wild population of salmon and steelhead that's adapted to a certain place, you can't get it back.
But we also, in the same interview, I talked to Naomi Rose, marine mammal scientist at the Animal Welfare Institute in Washington, D.C., and she strongly opposes the killing of these sea lions.
This is about pursuing a course that isn't going to work. Predator control very rarely works. Sea lions do, in fact, feed on species that feed on juvenile salmon. So, you know, removing them might actually cause more problem than you think because the fish that they also feed on that eat juvenile salmon may grow in size, you know, in population size.
So she says those 900 sea lions will die for nothing if we don't do what really matters, which she says is removing some dams, like on the Lower Snake River. And then there's how we feel about killing sea lions for the crime of eating something that we would like to eat, some of us, and we want other predators to eat. So, Tyrone, what do you make of this?
Just listening to these two stories back to back, it's just amazing that they're spinning around at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's all about life and death and what we preserve and what we allow to sort of happen naturally, right? And I think that it's a no-win situation in some ways, but I do like the idea of thinking ahead in terms of what we can do as voters and as civic leaders to address these problems. I mean, we can't sort of just say, well, throw our hands up and say that there's nothing we can do. But it seems rather extreme. When I first read the stories, I thought, my God, this is kind of crazy because we're also dealing with the story about, you know, the orca. But it leaves me feeling as if we are fighting all of these sort of battles around nature and how we interact with it, what we need from it, how we can harness it, how we can save it when it's threatened. And, you know, I'm a feature writer, right? So I try to look at things in the big picture. I don't cover policy. But again, I find it a rather moving experience to deal with these two stories simultaneously and to grapple with these bigger philosophical and societal questions. You know, how do we interact with nature and what do we do to intervene when we see trouble?
Yeah, it seems like if it's such an emergency, which obviously it is, then going after one small problem instead of the bigger problem, which didn't both of those scientists agree that dams and human behavior is by far the biggest
cause for these declining populations.
Yeah. So it seems
one of them is saying that the focus on one detracts from the other, and the other person's saying, well, that be that as it may, we've got to do something right now.
Yeah, I just think the something should be different. I mean, I think that predator control is a really risky thing to do. And, you know, there are always stories of introducing another predator to try to cut down on one population. And it has all of these dangerous effects because you're just disrupting the natural ecosystem. To me, it seems like if it's really a priority for us to preserve salmon and orcas, which are like so, so essential to the Pacific Northwest, then we should make it a priority.
Well, one of the things that one of the scientists pointed out in that interview, which you ran a fuller version of recently, was that this never works. And one reason it never works is there's a whole ecosystem. It's not just sea lions, you know, input, output. Sea lions consume Chinook salmon. And if you eliminate the sea lions, I mean, sea lions also prey on some of the Chinook salmon's predators. So, you know, there's consequences all down the line that, you know, that really are very, very hard to predict. And I mean, you know, I think of kudzu in the South, which was introduced to, you know, stop erosion, right? And I mean, and now it's everywhere. And like, what do you, I mean, there's absolutely no way to control it. There's accidental introductions like nutria in, you know, in Louisiana. There's just, this never goes well. We don't have examples where this has worked, and we can say, you know, yep, we killed off this whole, you know, half of this species and we solved the problem. I mean, it's the same thing. It requires a larger solution than just like eliminating 900 sea lions and hoping for the best.
We'll see what happens. I don't know whether this is going through Congress or not. I can't tell the political constituencies for it. But it's being supported by a couple of Congress members from Washington State. And we'll track that for you, this proposal to allow the permitting of almost 1,000 sea lions at certain spots, Bonneville Dam and others along that river system. We're going to come right back, and we're going to move back here to the West, and a city that has changed for better, for worse, a love-hate relationship, and more coming up on The Week in Review. You're listening to The Week in Review with my guests, Tyrone Beeson of Seattle Times, Erica C. Barnett, the C is for crank.com, Monica Nicholsberg with GeekWire. Seattle's Showbox Theater downtown has been a performance space for about 80 years. Duke Ellington played there, Nirvana, Pearl Jam played there. The owner wants to have it knocked down and building a high-rise apartment in its place. No way, said some people who came to a Landmark Preservation Board meeting this week.
Seen a lot of our local spaces go away, and we would hate to see the Showbox go away too.
And the last thing I want to see on behalf of the citizens of Seattle is art being ripped out of Seattle by developers.
So they want the Showbox to become a preserved historical landmark. The destruction of old buildings, the high rises, the growth and change, the pricing out of the non-rich, all of this and more inspired one of our panelists today to write a piece in the Seattle Times titled, I Hate You, Seattle, A Love Story. Tyrone Beeson, this was your story. What is that story?
Well, it was really inspired by my own anxiety about change in the city. I've lived here for 23 years. I came here from the South. And so Seattle was the largest city I'd ever lived in. And I really did have that sort of bright lights, big city experience when I came here, even though it really wasn't, of course, the biggest city by any means. But it really took hold of me and I fell in love with it. And recently, I've written a lot of stories about gentrification, about change, about how the city grapples with that and how our values and our priorities change along with buildings and spaces. And I wanted to get at that and work through it. And I didn't want to do a traditional story. I wanted to do something that felt more like a diary and that actually felt more like a conversation with the city. So I decided to treat the city the way I would a love interest with whom I'm kind of growing cold and grappling with that question of whether we should stay together. And I really did consider for a long time, and any friend who knows me knows that I've gone through this a lot recently, whether to stay in Seattle, in the new Seattle, whether this is the place for me. And so I wrote about a city that I felt I should hate, but that I really, really loved. But I needed to reconnect with what it is that made me love it. And
what is that made you love Seattle?
You know, when I came here from Kentucky, with all the cultural attributes that has, it's much more conservative, more rural. I mean, I grew up in a college town, grew up raising tobacco on my granddad's farm. I mean, it was a very different life. When I came to Seattle as an intern, it was also green, but green in a whole other way. There was this clear water. There was snow on the mountains, and everything about it seemed very much like the image of the Emerald City that the city kind of built itself as back then. And I just was sort of enraptured by it. And so, but it's more than that. The politics here were very different. It felt very open here, when I moved in the 90s, there was still a little bit of grit, actually. It felt...
Grit. What do you mean by grit?
It felt, the city had a little bit of a mix of high and low. A lot of people wore vintage clothing back then. I mean, it's still a thing here, but it was really a thing when I came here. Everybody wore plaid. There were piercings and tattoos, and you didn't have to sort of go to a neighborhood to find it. It was pretty thoroughly integrated with a lot of different neighborhoods. There was a vibe here that felt very edgy and iconoclastic, and people here had attitude. And attitude is something that is really underappreciated when we talk about how cities grow and change, but it felt as if the city belonged to itself and not to someone else's ideas about it. And what I feel now is that as Seattle pushes toward becoming a world-class city, it's other ideas about what a city is that are driving some of our decisions, you know. And it's not just growth. It's not just the fact that we have Amazon in our midst and sort of remaking things. The city is trying to figure out what it is now, what it wants to be. But I had to decide whether I wanted to be a part of that process. Ultimately, I decided to stay and to give it another shot and to renew my vows with the city.
But your relationship status is—it's complicated.
It's complicated, but you know, it's two people, right? It's two entities, and me and the city. And so, if anyone goes to my Instagram feed, you'll see that I wrote the story over a few months without telling anybody that I was doing that, because I wanted it to feel like a conversation that I was having with Seattle and a conversation that I was having with myself about why I want to stay here and whether I can see myself reflected in the shiny new buildings, in the rooftop bars, in the gentrified Central District. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things here that have changed that have given me a little bit of pause, but I wanted to find a way to love it. And that's a hard decision to make when you've been with somebody for a long time and you want to decide whether or not to continue that relationship. On what terms do you continue the relationship? And so that's what that was about. And then the story appeared last week, and I sort of explained what this was all about, all the pictures and video. But it was really a journalist's odyssey through his city to understand what made him stay here, but also why it is still lovable and, of course, livable. And it was an amazing experience. I went out day and night, and the pictures, a lot of those photos, certainly of me, were taken at 2, 3, 4 in the morning because I wanted the city to look empty, as I talked about how much more crowded and more and denser it is. So that sense of that I was having a conversation with the city alone in a private space, but in fact, I'm out in the city taking these photographs. But I tried to create scenes that had an intimacy and a quiet to them as I contemplated my relationship with it.
Erica C. and Monica, can you relate?
I mean, I've lived here for, since 2001, so I wasn't here in the 90s, but it has changed tremendously in the time that I've lived here. I think that one thing that gets lost when we, when any of us, and Monica, probably not you yet, but just wait, when you're in your 40s, you will look back on the time when you were in your 20s. For me, it was Austin in the 90s. Man, that was the best.
Like, that was the coolest.
That was
Austin,
the coolest
the
time that it's ever been. It sucks now, and everybody's boring, and there's nothing good there. But of course, like some part of that is you wish you were in your 20s, and you know people are in their 20s now having a different experience, and so there's a lot that's changed about the city that I find troubling. The fact that it's so expensive here. I think again, talk about policy solutions. These are solvable problems, but you know, in order to not have like ugly, stupid looking townhomes, we have to have policies that allow more housing. And that's really hard. But, you know, I see that as a policy issue. Just from the living in Seattle point of view, I lived in Ballard when I first moved here almost 20 years ago. It was dead. It was so boring. And I couldn't sleep at night. It was so quiet. And I mean, honestly, it's now Ballard is a destination. I don't live north of the Ship Canal anymore. I live closer to I-90. But it's a place that I intentionally go, which is like was unheard of. There's a light rail. People can connect to more parts of the city than they've ever been able to connect to without driving a car. There's art spaces all over the city that weren't there. Now, they might not be in the areas where you remember them from when, you know, from the 90s or the 2000s. But I mean, my concern about specifically things like the Showbox and, you know, changing our historic preservation laws so we can say this has to be a music venue or a bookstore or a record store or a video store in perpetuity forever is that, like, that's great if we want the museum to be, if we want the city to be a museum for people my age. But and so I'll always be able to go to Scarecrow Video, and I'll always be able to go to Finney Books, and I'll always be able to go to, you know, name your favorite place. But people Monica's age won't be able to, will have less opportunity. I mean, I'm not picking on you. I'm just saying, like, people who are in their 20s will have less opportunities and less spaces to create a city for them. And I don't think the city should be a city for people, you know, in their 40s. I mean, I think it's, you know, I have a place here. My place has changed here since I was in my 20s. And I have chosen to stay here, even though I'm getting priced out. I mean, it's rents are crazy, and I can't buy a house. But I love this city, and part of what I love about it is the way it has changed, and the way it, I mean, you used to not be able to fly out of here to so many places that you can fly out now. Mm-hmm. You used to, I mean, the streets used to roll up at 9 o'clock, and that's not how it is anymore. And I think it's, I mean, I think for the most part, it's for the good.
Yeah, I'm in my 20s, as you might have guessed from listening to this. And I moved here 4.5 years ago when I was 22 because I loved it. And I still love it, even though it's changed even in those 4 years. My rent was $400 when I first moved here. But
where?
It was a pretty crappy apartment.
Okay.
But so when I first read the headline of your story, I was immediately like kind of prickly and defensive, because I've had a lot of these conversations with folks who they Seattle sucks now, and they lament the change. And I was like ready to defend it because I love it, even though it has its problems. But then I read the story and I actually identified with it so much. It was really beautiful. And there was this one part where you talked about like love for a place being like love for a person, because it requires constant attention. And that I wish is something that we all thought about more, because you can't just freeze it in time and love it as it was. You have to keep actively trying to love it if you care about it in this deep way. And when I meet people, whether they moved here yesterday or 20 years ago, by far the first thing that they tell me is that they love Seattle. They moved here because they love it. They love how beautiful it is. They love having been in a city with mountains on either side and all these natural water features. And they love the progressive politics. And if everybody loves it, whether they are brand new or a veteran, then I feel like there's more to be optimistic about than pessimistic about.
I would agree with that. And in the story, I even talk about, I talk a lot about checking myself, checking my nostalgia. But just yesterday, speaking of the new Seattle, I was just at Treason Gallery in Pioneer Square, where the London-based street artist D-Face was holding, had his first Seattle exhibit. And he's a lover of sort of the old Seattle, the Seattle of the Nirvana and Mudhoney days and Sub Pop Records. But this exhibit is really cool, because the introductory placard said something that I feel myself, and he wanted to combat the idea that nostalgia is the enemy of progress. I think that's how he put it. And I really feel strongly about that. There's a place for history and culture and heritage, even as a city grows, and young people appreciate that as much as people my age. I appreciated it when I was 22 and an intern, and I appreciate it now that I'm 46. There's a place for all these things in a changing city, and it's an important question for us to ask as residents, as stakeholders here. The reason that I wrote this story as one about grappling with nostalgia is not because I'm living in the past. It's because I can go to the Showbox today. I can go to the train car house party in Soto today. I don't want to be 21 again. I want to have a city that's livable for me now. And when I go to these spaces, what's really amazing is that most of the people who are there are in their 20s and 30s. So I get to interact with New Seattle, even as I vibe with the things that make me feel connected to the Seattle that I knew when I moved here. So I think I'm glad that you said that, because I think there's a beauty in respecting the past. But there's something really beautiful about what's happening in Seattle now, and it's certainly exciting. And I want to be a part of that. You know, I want to be a part of that change, and not, as I said in the piece, be that guy in the rearview mirror who's lamenting the old days. I want to be a part of the new Seattle, but I want Rebar to be there too. I want the Showbox to be a part of that as well. I want artists and baristas and rockers to be, and tattoo artists to be a part of the new Seattle. And as you indicated, Erica, that's becoming more difficult as well. The people who help create culture and create cool are finding it increasingly difficult to do those things in a city that they love. And that's a problem.
I totally agree, and but I you know, since I write about policy, mm-hmm. primarily, what I think about is like, well, what can we do? Mm-hmm. And not like what is worth saving, because I do think that is to a huge extent subjective. You know, I would, you know, if we're going to have a rebar, you know, historical preservation meeting, you know, I will be there testifying against it, because I don't think we should say this specific private business needs to be, you know, needs to have government intervention on its behalf, for the most part. But I do think that there is value in figuring out how can we make the city a place where, you know, those people who create cultural institutions can live, and how do we make it a place where, you know, the rebar, whoever, doesn't need to move out if they don't want to. I mean, sometimes people want to close down their businesses, but in, you know, in specific instances, like, what do we do? How do we support small businesses? You know, I don't think Seattle is like a particularly welcoming place for small businesses in a lot of ways. And I think there are policies we can adopt. I think we should have more accessible, affordable housing for artists. I think that's incredibly important. You know, I mean, these are things we should be like talking about and adopting policies and spending money on. But historic preservation, which is what the policy thing that's being discussed right now for the Showbox or the Rebar or my favorite bar or my favorite bookstore, just puts us on a really dangerous slippery slope, where you also have the businesses that the majority rally around being protected, and businesses where you don't have an influential constituency. And usually, you know, when you're talking about majority culture, it's wealthier and whiter. Mm-hmm. When you don't have that constituency, people, those disappear, and City Hall never notices. Mm-hmm. And so we need to work on that problem too.
And we're going to move on to some of the other big news stories of the week. I wanted to highlight, since we have Tyrone here, just highlight a really well-written piece. And it sounds from your description that we're next to each other, maybe all three of us, dancing to Sister Sledge at the Rebar on the same night. I think I was there. Yeah, we might have been. But
I was with you in spirit.
You were there? Okay, that's right. It was a little early for you. Yeah, yeah. So again, the piece in the Seattle Times is titled "I Hate You, Seattle: A Love Story," written by Tyrone Beeson. And we've got Erica C. Barnett. We've got Monica Nicholsberg from Geek Wire. We're going to talk about some innovation. Let's talk about another side of tech growth in just a moment on The Week in Review. The Week in Review, continuing now, live tweeting at KUOW. And we were just talking about Seattle growing pains, high home prices, and there's homelessness, and there's traffic, and big tech companies growing in the city limits is part of the problem. And this week, Seattle's mayor tried to make some of those companies a part of the solution. Jenny Durkin went to the downtown headquarters of Zillow to announce a new Innovation Advisory Council.
This new collaboration with Seattle's technology community will help us surface the data, know where the gaps are, look for technology solutions that can make us a more equitable and vibrant city. And we really want to make sure that this technology and data is harnessed in a way that increases equity rather than hardening inequity.
GeekWire's Monica Nicholsberg, you wrote about this innovation group in GeekWire. Who's on it? What are they going to do?
That's right. Yeah. And I was there yesterday at Zillow. So Zillow is participating, Expedia, Amazon, Microsoft, Tableau, a handful of others, the Washington Technology Industry Association, and each of those organizations is going to identify an individual to sit on this advisory council.
And what are they going to do?
They're going to advise.
Is the city hiring these companies? I mean, do we have a contract?
No. It's an executive order that Mayor Durkin signed, and it actually did come up in the press conference, this idea of, okay, so what if they identify a solution that could be, that technology could facilitate? Like, she gave the example of coordinating the navigation team who handles much of our homeless response, so that instead of having to call up individual shelters and find out if there's availability, it could be like an app at hotel where you can see all of the availability across hotels in a city. But one of my fellow reporters asked, okay, well, are these companies going to donate money? Or I was curious if maybe they would donate employee time, resources, and the mayor didn't really give a clear answer on that, but stressed that it's mainly going to be in an advisory capacity. So I'm a little bit skeptical about whether solutions will actually get off the ground, because it's all well and good to identify them, but building technology products costs money and resources.
Yeah. So building an app to show you what's available, is that beyond a typical city, a big city's capability? Is that something you need a tech innovation group for?
Well, it's not something you need it for, but boy, they are a lot better at it than we are as a city. Uh-huh. I mean, than the government is. And I mean, I think that what kind of frustrated me about this story, or about reading about this Innovation Council, is that it does seem like it's going to be another advisory group of tech leaders who will get good PR out of, you know, seeming as though they are committed to solving the problem. And it's homelessness, transportation, and other issues to be determined. So it's already like spread thin over, here are all the biggest issues in the city, go give us some suggestions. When they could actually just create a council to figure out how to essentially do the coordinated entry system, which is kind of how everybody who is homeless and in the shelter system gets processed through that system. So that, you know, somebody on the navigation team who's out in an encampment could have their iPad, look at it, 2 seconds, here are all the available shelter beds. Now they have to call them on the phone. That's like, I mean, it's not 1980. So if they created a council and said, do that, spend some money on it, Tableau could do that. I mean, they have the technology, but it sounds like that's not what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do think that's the idea of this council, is to identify places like that where data and technology could be used. But it's, I think, like everything, a question of resources and who's going to build it if we can find the areas where that would help.
I mean, it would create tremendous goodwill if Amazon and some of the other companies that fought the head tax so hard were to actually say, sure, we'll spend $10 million on this, or, you know, something that's a relative pittance to, you know, the collective wealth of these companies, and we're going to solve coordinated entry. Like, bam, done, 6 months. That would create tremendous PR goodwill, and it would actually be a real thing that you could see results on the ground.
Yeah, I agree. I think if the city can get firm commitments of material resources, either in terms of people or other types of resources, to make this more than an advisory involvement, I think that would be great. The city clearly needs to rebuild perhaps its relationship with this particular industry, and this is a great start. But there's a tremendous amount of brain power at these companies, and if they can, as you indicated, donate employee time or other kinds of resources, I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. I don't know that they're definitely not going to do that. It just, from the information that we had yesterday, the future seems a little bit murky. It hasn't really been fleshed out whether it's just going to be advice or if it's going to be advice and something else.
Well, so after this meet, or after this after the show, there's going to be a meeting of One Table, which is the massive sort of advisory group that's countywide and region-wide.
It's local governments.
It's local governments and also business leaders, will be very interesting, because they were supposed to have wrapped up their recommendations and, you know, be moving toward policy solutions months ago. They haven't met since April. And it's been really unclear what they've been doing. And so when I hear the words advisory council, I get very nervous and just think, well, this is like another black hole to send a bunch of, you know, people into. And are they going to emerge with anything, or are they just going to be, you know, a One Table style sort of situation where, you know, I don't know how many of these business leaders showed up after the very first initial meeting and to what extent they just kind of sent underlings after that or didn't come. But it will be very interesting to see if there's actual results out of that, because that'll be an indication perhaps of how serious this latest advisory council is going to be.
Yeah. And one other thing that's come up a lot with our readers is that, should this really be the place where we're looking for solutions anyway from the business community, which I think you could make an argument on either side of, but, you know, one person wrote to me and she said, is this just another committee of people advising on homelessness that doesn't include anybody who's not housed or anyone who's actually dealing with these issues? If you were looking at it from a technology perspective, it might be your end user. You know, you would never build a product without consulting them, because they're the ones who have the problem you're trying to solve. So I think there's a lot here, and there is a concern from a lot of people that this is just giving more license to the business community to influence city policy without really asking for anything in return.
Well, technology's done so much to organize us, you know, for better or for worse, and to track us for better or for worse, but it's tempting to think that, well, maybe Amazon and those people with those tools can do something about even social justice that we haven't been able to do. It's tempting.
It's tempting, but I think, you know, I think we have to limit our expectations to the actual skill sets of those companies, and which is why I'm saying when we have a database of people, which we do, and whether you think that's, you know, a problem or not, that ship has kind of sailed, and that's the system that we're working with, where we have a database of people and it's really hard to track where they are or what services they've gotten or, you know, where there are shelter beds open. They have a skill set that actually can apply to that. Now, if we get into like creating apps for people to give money to homeless people on the street, then I have a real issue with that, because you do need to talk to the end users and you do need to think about what are we saying about ourselves as a society by encouraging this kind of, you know, depersonalized giving. But as far as, you know, as go maintain this database and make it better, I would be optimistic, except that this is an advisory council in an administration that has quite a lot of them, and we haven't seen a lot of results yet on this very difficult issue.
That's Erica C. Barnett. She's on her way after the show to another advisory council, local governments and businesses, one table. And we've been talking about the Innovation Advisory Council that Mayor Durkan talked about, announced at the downtown headquarters of Zillow this week. Coming up, we're going to talk about plastic, untraceable guns that you can make on a 3D printer. Talk about bike share and Drizzle and more. Stay tuned. We're reviewing the week together because it's the week in review, and we have Monica Nicholsberg from GeekWire and Erica C. Barnett, the C is for Crank, and Tyrone Beeson, social justice columnist, Seattle Times. And another story this week, a federal judge in Seattle blocked a group from publishing downloadable blueprints for printing guns. You can use 3D printers to squirt out plastic in the right shape to make a gun that can fire. An organization called Defense Distributed wants to publish online instruction manuals for doing that. Washington and other states sued to stop them. Here's Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson at that news conference.
The Trump administration recently chose to give access to potentially untraceable and undetectable firearms to any felon, domestic abuser, or terrorist with a laptop and access to a 3D printer.
Well, Ferguson won around this week getting that temporary restraining order. But I also talked to someone this week who supports the right to publish those gun printing instructions. Lara Smith with the Liberal Gun Club says the ability to make your own gun is not new and it's not illegal.
If you Google zip gun on the internet, you'll find out that you can go to Home Depot and for about $10 make a single shot 22 weapon from things you can buy there any day. If criminals wanted to use this technology, it's been there forever, and they can use it.
Monica, you wrote a bit about this in GeekWire. How important is it whether these printing instructions are legally published online?
Well, that's a good question. How important is it?
She's making the case that not very, because this is not new technology. You can do this kind of thing.
I think if you are looking at it from the perspective of how important is it for us to have policies that reflect our values, then there's a strong case to be made to say that we shouldn't allow anyone and everyone to get access to the guides to make their own guns, because guns are something that we want to regulate and we don't want them to be in anyone's hands. If you're thinking about it more from a practical standpoint, many of these blueprints are already available online. They were before the Obama administration cracked down on them. And as everybody knows, once something's on the internet, it never really dies. So whatever happens in the litigation of this particular lawsuit, I think we have reached the point where these plans are out there. We haven't reached the point where 3D printers are so widely available. Even hobbyists tend to go use like a public shared machine. But when we get there, that's going to be a whole other discussion. But yeah, I think whether we like it or not, this is our reality.
Yeah, we had a big discussion this week about that these are plastic guns. They're going to melt with more than one round. Well, no, not true. Or they're going to be traceable because you have to have metal in a gun. But someone else saying you could easily remove that metal and one round can get past a metal detector. I mean, there's a lot going on about how concerned we ought to be.
I mean, I think that even if we can't regulate the internet and keep stuff off the internet, we can regulate guns, and, you know, we can regulate use. We can create laws around use of, you know, of 3D printers. I mean, you can buy all the ingredients to make meth and other drugs at a drugstore, and we also don't allow people to make meth at home. I mean, those two things can both coexist. I don't think the fact that it's possible means we should just throw up our hands and say, well, I guess, you know, we're just going to let people carry guns through metal detectors at airports now and let domestic abusers who are banned from buying guns make them at home or make them in a hobby shop. I mean, it's...
And the law, I should point out, does say that you're not supposed to have these plastic, these printer guns if you have a domestic violence conviction, for example. There's certain class of people, and you're supposed that we could require you to register it, and you're not supposed to sell it. And like, we have the rules, but it's getting harder to enforce rules as we can print a gun at home.
But from a regulatory perspective, what's really fascinating about this particular lawsuit is Defense Distributed, the group that wants to publish the tutorials, they're not making a Second Amendment claim. They're making a First Amendment claim. They're saying that it's a violation of their right of freedom of speech to say that they can't put information online, which is, like, you know, we've seen that argument with other texts that seem like they promote violence, Anarchist Cookbook, for example. But it is really kind of a fascinating question, because he's saying, I'm not selling the guns. I'm not even necessarily going to make them. I'm just arming people with the information to make them themselves. And so where do you regulate? Do you do it at the point where the person's printing the gun or owning it or selling it or firing it? I mean, these are things that we've really not figured out very well as a country.
Yeah, that argument is a little too clever by half. But I like Erica's idea. There are solutions at the policy level to regulate guns, right, or access to firearms. So that might be our only way, especially in a period where technology is leapfrogging beyond laws so greatly. This might be the way to sort of play catch up. But that's a huge dilemma. I mean, it is a free speech issue, I suppose. But really, this is about something even greater than that, I think.
We've got time to get to one more story of regulation, I guess. You know, the bike shares, the colorful bikes you see parked all over Seattle. You unlock a bike with your app, you take your ride, you leave it there for the next rider. They've been convenient for some people, not convenient if it's parked in your way, especially if you've got mobility issues. And this week, the city said it's going to charge bike share companies $250,000 a year to operate here. Again, Monica, you wrote about this. How's that going to change life around here?
Well, the yellow bikes that you see in Seattle right now are going away probably by the end of the month. That's
OFO.
OFO announced right after the city adopted this $250,000 annual fee that they were going to be leaving Seattle. And that has, like, led to some speculation that this might cool down the bike share market, and it's a really important new mobility service. But the thing that I just always try to stress is that OFO was already laying off most of its American workforce and pulling out of many cities. So the timing of it is a little, it gives an impression that might not be the whole story.
Right.
And some of the big players that are coming into bike share, including Uber and Lyft, have not weighed in on this issue. Now, of course, that makes sense. $250,000 is probably pocket change for them.
Mm-hmm.
But this works out to about $50 a bike. And, you know, is that onerous? I mean, we'll see when the bids come in, because they're doubling the number of bikes that'll be allowed. And I think they're expanding it to five companies.
Four.
Yeah.
We have about 10,000, and the ceiling's going to be 20,000.
20,000. And so, or 5,000 each. And so, so we'll see what happens. I mean, it does strike me that Seattle has this incredible resistance to ever being first at anything. And when we are first at something, like we were with bike share, we have, I think, 1 in 4 of the bike share bikes in the country are in Seattle right now. It's been an incredible success that has some problems around people with mobility limitations. And is our response going to be, well, let's just regulate them out of business? I am inclined to think that $250,000 is not actually that much money for these companies, and that they'll be able to handle it. But we'll see. I mean, we'll see when the bids come in.
I think "we'll see" is the operative phrase there, because, like, Lime Bike, right after the announcement was made, they said that they are going to apply for a permanent permit. They want to stay in Seattle for sure. That's the green bikes that you see out there.
Mm-hmm.
But these bike sharing companies and new mobility companies are so heavily funded. I mean, they've got hundreds of millions of dollars in venture funding for a model that, at least in the U.S., is sort of untested. It's pretty new. And now we're already moving on to scooters, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yes, we'll talk about scooters. That's there's just not much happening on that yet. Scooter share in Seattle. It's time to go. You know, summer is a big biking season because it's warm and dry and light, except suddenly the last couple of days it got drizzly and cloudy. Tyrone, what's better, 93 degrees or 67 and drizzly that we suddenly have come to?
I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for this, but 93 and sunny. I'm a southern boy. I like the sun. I like the heat. And, you know, I sit in the shade and have a cool drink when it's hot.
My poor wife really feels like summer's over, even though it's August, whatever, 4th.
You know, I'm from Texas, as I'm sure everybody I know is sick of hearing me say. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from Houston. It's 100 degrees there. Now, the difference is in Houston, we have AC and it's 60 degrees inside.
Right.
So I was happy for the break in my apartment, which has been 90 degrees.
I like it sunny. It's such a short period of the year. And like you said, it feels like it's already over. It was like, you got July, that was summer. Now it's going to be raining until next July.
It's too soon.
I think it'll be back. Thanks for tuning into The Week in Review. And our panel, Tyrone Beeson, social justice columnist, Seattle Times. Erica C. Barnett writes at thecisforcrank.com. Monica Nicholsberg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire. Thanks, everybody. Great to see you. I enjoyed this. And the show is produced by Amin Al-Sadi. Our social media producer is Kara McDermott. You know we're on Twitter, at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Monday on the show, you're going to hear from Democrats running to replace the retiring Dave Reichert in the 8th District. Hope you can join us.